Good morning, all. I'm going to call the meeting of Energy and Climate to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Long, have you been able to review the minutes and move approval of the minutes of February 21st?
I have, Madam Chair, and I move approval of the minutes.
All the
next question.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposition? Minutes are adopted. We're going to have a governor's budget overview from the PCA, and we welcome Greta Gauthier. And if you would put your name on the record, and do you have a question?
Madam Chair, I do. And again, I'm glad the PCA folks are here to talk about things. With the governor's changes and with our restructuring of the committees from last year, could you tell me what is the, do we have any jurisdiction over the PCA accounts that we'll be addressing today, Madam Chair?
I don't believe we have jurisdiction over these accounts. We have a jurisdiction over some commerce accounts. However, what PCA is doing is talking about climate issues, and because they're talking about climate issues and that's our jurisdiction, we're going to hear from them.
I just want to understand that. Okay, thank you.
Good morning, members. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Greta Gauthier, Assistant Commissioner for Legislative Relations at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. With me today.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Craig McDonald, and I serve as Assistant Commissioner for Air and Climate Policy at the Pollution Control Agency.
So we'll get going, Madam Chair. We have four items in our this year's governor's budget request that relate to climate. So we will go over those with the committee today. First, just for new members, a little background about our agency. We are the state level delegated agency by the US EPA to enforce some federal laws in Minnesota. Our mission is to protect and improve the environment and human health. We have six regional offices around the state. About two-thirds of our staff are in the Twin Cities, and the rest are regional. Our agency was set up in 1967. We're about 900 FTE. It fluctuates. We hire people to do water monitoring in the summer, usually college students, so the number of FTEs kind of fluctuates. But we do have a very low turnover rate, and we are 48% women. 70% of our staff are scientists, engineers, chemists, hydrologists, geochemists, biologists, and other environmental specialists. Our statutory authority is that we operate under 229 state laws that apply to us and direct our program operations. And then again, we have delegated authority from the federal government. You see some examples in our air, water, and land programs of the things that we have delegated authority over. And Madam Chair, I just threw in this photo on this slide for a little bit of history. This is a photo from the early 1960s when there were a couple of oil spills that resulted in the Mississippi River being coated with oil from St. Paul down to Lake Pepin. And the two gentlemen here, the man in the suit is Governor Karl Rolvaag, and the other man is a citizen from Pine Bend, Minnesota, who was so concerned about the waterfowl that got caught in that oil slick that he brought several bushels full of oiled dead waterfowl and dumped them in the Capitol Rotunda. And then they got taken out. There was another picture of Karl Rolvaag at the site. At the time this happened, there was no agency that could respond to something like this. So 5 years after this occurred, the Pollution Control Agency was formed, and 3 years after that, in 1970, the US EPA was formed. So just a little history about how we got here in the first place. We have, as I said, four climate items to talk to you about today, and I'm going to turn it over to Craig to talk about the first two.
So, as you can see, the governor has proposed a one-time general fund appropriation of $250,000 for a new statewide engagement and outreach initiative to support the development and implementation of climate policies. As this committee has heard, climate change impacts all of us. Everyone from farmers who are facing challenges associated with increasing numbers of extreme weather events to folks living in urban areas with increasing, you know, warming temperatures in the summer are seeing the impacts. The 2007 Next Generation Energy Act laid out a series of greenhouse gas emissions reductions targets, and without additional efforts and robust public-private collaboration, we're not likely to achieve the goals of the Next Generation Energy Act. Interest in climate change is high, and there's a growing urgency for ensuring Minnesota's future is sustainable. Under this initiative, the MPCA, working with all the agencies in the state, will host a series of statewide public meetings, developments of communication materials, and participation in, by businesses and non-governmental entities. This proposal will help inform the climate policies of the state, including mitigation and adaptation policies, and ensure that all people have access to the decision-making processes that impact their lives. While the communities of Minnesota may look different across the state, and climate adaptation and mitigation strategies may look different as well, we all share the same goals. We want our state to be resilient and well-positioned to be a leader in the green job economy, and this proposal helps achieve that. Our second proposal is some increased funding for electric vehicle infrastructure charging, or charging infrastructure. The governor recommends appropriating $1.5 million from the general fund in a one-time appropriation in fiscal year 2020 to the Pollution Control Agency, and then dedicating $50,000 per year in ongoing funding from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund for electric vehicle charging infrastructure. As you know, the transportation sector has eclipsed the electricity generation sector as the largest emitter of greenhouse gases in Minnesota. And while Minnesota's EV infrastructure is growing, demand for increased charging options remains high among EV owners and potential EV owners. In fact, as part of the agency's VW settlement agreement, we hosted a series of stakeholder engagement sessions, and increased electric vehicle charging infrastructure was one of the top demands of the public. This is illustrated by the demand received for charging infrastructure under our EV RFP, the charging infrastructure RFP. We had $1.4 million available for fast chargers, but demand was at $3.2 million. And for level two chargers, there were requests for $500,000, while we only had $158,000. So the funds from this proposal will be distributed via the agency's existing EV charging infrastructure grant program, and we will distribute the funds in a way that is efficient and economical, and we will get the funds out the door using this existing infrastructure.
Continuing on, Madam Chair and members, the next two proposals made by the governor are impacting climate change from a different aspect, and that is in relation to solid waste. Both, one is about food waste, and the other one is about recycling markets. So I'll start with the food waste. Currently, food waste is about 30% of all the trash, the waste stream that we have in Minnesota. If we could divert that from landfills, there would be numerous benefits, including reduced levels of methane when landfills, it is the organic waste going into landfills that creates the wet conditions that allows the bacteria to feed that creates the methane that comes off landfills. So there would be methane improvements. Also, it would give us an opportunity to divert more of this food to useful purposes like feeding people and animals. So I'll just go through this a little bit. As you know, we have there are recycling and composting 75% of a material goal, and that is for the metro area. The idea of getting food waste out of the waste stream is the biggest single way that we can bend this curve on the demand for landfills. Our proposal has two main targets. One is food waste reduction and rescue. So the rescue would be both retail, so for example, food from grocery stores that is near expiration but not expired can be rescued and taken to food shelves or food banks. And the other would be prepared food. So there are trials going on right now around the state to work with large cafeterias to get prepared food at the end of the day that has not been served, for example, to local soup kitchens and avoid that food going into the waste stream. That's one area is food waste reduction and rescue. The other is removing some barriers that exist right now that are keeping organic collection or organic waste collection from expanding, and also recovery systems. So we would also be looking at how to address PFAS or PFCs and other chemicals in that family, which are currently an issue nationwide for recycling facilities, that there are now some are detecting PFAS in the water coming off of their processes. So helping to address some of those barriers, Madam Chair. In addition, we estimate that there would be greenhouse gas impacts, and I do have an estimate of those. So in terms of energy savings, we estimate that there would be about 6,800 metric tons of carbon equivalent GHG savings per year. And then from the saving of all the energy that goes into the production of the food, we estimate there would be about 23,920 metric tons of carbon equivalent BTUs a year, assuming that we would be preventing 3.5 million pounds of food waste when this is fully implemented. So there would be greenhouse gas impacts also. And then we also want to analyze emerging technologies to help them get to market faster. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll go to our last proposal, which this is in response to an action recently taken by China to refuse, they no longer are accepting recycled materials from the United States. And this is causing a problem for our recyclers and for industries that use recycled materials. So what this program is grants at $800,000 a biennium ongoing from the Environmental Fund, which is one of the funds that pays for our work at the PCA. And this is to develop new value-added and other businesses to spur growth, more growth in recycling markets and support recycling markets in Minnesota at this volatile time. Prices for recycled goods are record low because of what's happened in China. So we want to try to support the industry that we do have. We have a more robust in recycling reuse industry in Minnesota than any of our neighboring states. And so we want to make sure that that industry can survive this glitch and expand to accommodate the impacts of what's happened. Basically, we would require a match from these grants, and we're going to be trying to help companies cover the things that banks and lenders generally do not cover, so that they can secure funding and start their businesses. With that, Madam Chair, we can stand for questions. And thank you again for the opportunity to present our ideas here before your committee today.
There are questions. We're going to start with Representative Acom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have just a couple of questions for Mr. McDonald. Your climate and outreach and engagement. You talked about how important it is statewide, and I appreciate that. And so I'm just wondering, do you have any deliverables that will come out of that process?
Madam Chair and members, we do have deliverables. It would be the engagement process would yield a report that would help for a roadmap to identify where support for climate strategies and policies would be across the state, as well as the report would highlight some of the successes that communities have had in adapting to climate change. For instance, we were just in Duluth last week, and the Lake Walk in Duluth is being completely rebuilt after a devastating storm. So it highlights some of those successes, as well as the challenges that local communities are facing as it relates to adapting to climate.
Thank you. And then I just have one other question, and it was about the electric vehicle infrastructure. And can you tell me, how much does it cost to install a fast charger and then also a level two?
Yes.
Please. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, just 1 second while I look at the facts. It's a sliding scale, but for a level two charger, the estimated cost could be $2,000 to $5,000. And for a fast charger, it could be anywhere from $60,000 to up to over $150,000, depending on the technology.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the electric vehicles proposal, you mentioned the VW settlement and that you had
2 to 2.5 times the demand as what you were able to provide. Can you talk a little bit about what that demand involved? Were those applications that were coming into you, and what are some of the projects that were left on the table?
Madam Chair and Representative Long, the demand was for individuals who submitted a proposal for charging projects. Specifics I don't have at the moment, but you can see that that figure showed the number of projects that we were just not able to fund. I can follow up with the specific number of projects that did not receive funding.
And Madam Chair, also background on the VW settlement. So we are phasing that money. So Minnesota, like every state, got funds from the settlement that the Justice Department, U.S. Justice Department, had with Volkswagen over their intentionally falsified mechanical parts of their diesel engines. Minnesota's, the amounts are doled out based on the number of offending cars that were registered in each state. So obviously California and New York got a lot more than we did, but we do get $47 million over a span of 10 years. And we had about 15 stakeholder meetings to decide that we would phase that out in three phases. And the first phase, we put out 25% of that money. And so the amount that we offered for electric vehicles was what all of the stakeholders and we thought was probably a fair assessment of where the demand would be. So we were very surprised when it came back much higher than that, number one. And number two, however, the federal court settlement does limit states. They can only spend 15% of the Volkswagen settlement on electric vehicle infrastructure. That's why the governor would like to accelerate electric vehicle infrastructure with this $1.5 million and then the $50,000 a year from the EV registration fee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have a sense, so you had the applications that you got in for this money. Some people might have self-selected out since you had a capped amount. And there may not have been, may have been other people who just couldn't get the applications together. Has the MPCA done an analysis of what the overall demand, or rather need, for EV charging infrastructure in the state is?
Madam Chair and Representative Long, so the Department of Transportation just came out with a new study this month, called Accelerating Electric Vehicle Adoption, A Vision for Minnesota, and we'll be happy to send you a link if you haven't seen that yet. What our plan is after the first round of these electric, or of the VW grants, so they are to replace a number of different types of diesel engines, and we have 6 grant programs, then we are going to look at the results of all of them, working with stakeholders in a public engagement process, and figure out what we should do in the next round when we put about half, or about $23 million out for grants. So we will definitely be looking at the high levels of demand for EV vehicle charging stations. We also have very high levels of demand for cleaner school buses. So we'll be looking, once we're through the whole process, because we're also replacing engines in off-road and on-road heavy-duty vehicles, and in things like locomotives, tugboats, ground control equipment at the airports, that sort of thing. We'll look at all of that, and where did demand come in based on where kind of this consensus that we had with stakeholders was. And then we'll be putting out a new plan for the second round of that funding. So, yes, we will be taking all of this into account, and I'd be happy to share with you. I can share with you now the list of people who applied and what they applied for, and those grants are close to being announced, and then once they're announced, once they're all completed and executed the contracts, then we can announce them all and give you that information as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One additional question on the organics proposal. You mentioned the greenhouse gas savings. Can you talk a little bit about how that savings comes to be? What is being displaced, and what results in those savings?
Madam Chair and Representative Long, I will do my best. My understanding from our technical staff who calculated this for us yesterday is that for the greenhouse gas savings of 6,800 metric tons of carbon equivalent, CO2 equivalent. We are looking at a baseline scenario of annual waste, organics waste, going 46.2% to waste to energy facilities and 57.4% landfilled. And then for the BTUs, I said that we're assuming 3.5 million pounds of food waste prevented. I have several paragraphs detailing how they got to those calculations, which I'd be happy, I can read those off or I can send those to the committee for your perusal.
If you'd be willing to send them, that'd be great.
Happy to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you'd send them to us, we will get them to every committee member.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I really appreciate your focus on food waste reduction. And so my question is, I know that the counties track and keep data on their recycling rates over time. And so we have like a trend line, is it going up, is it going down? I know not all counties are doing organics or they're doing it in different ways, but is there sort of longitudinal annual data being collected on levels of food waste, recycling, organics, composting, et cetera, that we have on a statewide basis or even county by county basis, so that we kind of know the trend here?
Madam Chair and members, I believe you have a, I believe there is a chart in the change item of our budget, which probably is not before you, that I can send to you, that does look at, it looks at organics management by method. I don't know that we're looking at, are you talking about waste composition studies?
Madam Chair, just the relative rates of, organics, composting, and recycling that is being diverted from incinerators and landfills, that would be good data to have. I know that in our goal, our 75% goal, I believe it's 60% recycling and 15% organics. Mm-hmm. So how are we doing in terms of getting to that goal, over time? Are we making progress, or is it kind of flat like a lot of the recycling rates are? Is it dipping for some reason? It would be helpful to have that data.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to supply that for you. I don't have that with me today. However, I can tell you that we currently estimate about only 17% of Minnesotans have access to curbside organics recycling. So we do definitely have room to grow.
So, Madam Chair, I think that this would be really important to look at, in terms of being able to expand this. I liken this to maybe where recycling was in the early 70s. And so, once we were able to build the infrastructure for, regular materials recycling, it took off, and I think we could potentially see the same thing with organics. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple more follow-up questions on some of what we've talked about already. On the statewide public meeting schedule, have the sites been determined for that?
Madam Chair and representatives, they have not.
Okay. And then we'll follow up on the VW settlement funds. Were all of those funds provided to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to work with? Is that where they all went, or were there extraneous?
Madam Chair and Representative Bierman, yes, so the federal court order required each state to set up a designated agency, and the court also set up a trustee to look over the funds, which is a bank called Wilmington Trust in Wilmington, Delaware.
Okay.
And so each state had to sign an agreement with Wilmington Trust, and each governor designated which of their state agencies would be the agency to actually pass these grant monies out into the communities, and that's our agency in Minnesota.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. One more question. Switching to water testing, could you just comment briefly on what you're testing water for, what you're finding, what your main concerns are, maybe one and two, and what action plans might be in the works now?
Madam Chair and members, I'm very sorry, Representative Bierman, Representative Bierman, I don't have all of that information with me right now. I apologize, I wasn't prepared for that today, but I'd be happy to come and meet with you and also to supply that to the committee if that would be of assistance.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, testifier. Forgive me if you answered this in the electrical vehicle discussion, but I'm just curious about how decisions are made about where charging stations are needed. So I'm assuming it has something to do with population, but how do you track where the electric cars are, et cetera?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Christensen. So that is something that was addressed in the recent MnDOT report that came out. And I believe there's a packet of fact sheets that you have, and one of them has a map like this on it, or else they are posted on the committee's website. So this is a map that MnDOT, in assistance assisted by us and the Great Plains Institute, it's part of the study they just put out to show in the blue lines where the existing EV charging infrastructure is, and then in the green lines where from a traffic and miles traveled and so forth, a registration of EVs, other of MnDOT's information, where it makes sense to put additional electric vehicle charging stations next. And then the shaded area here shows that is the part of Minnesota at which wherever you live in that shaded area, within 25 miles, there is an existing charging station already. So in the VW funds, we worked very closely with stakeholders to determine where the priority areas were, and then we got a lot of applications, and those applications were ranked based on criteria that were set by the federal court and by the stakeholder group. And so that was how the determination was made of where the available funds in this round of the grants would be put.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair and members, yes. To that point, in the report, there's Appendix D, which is a list of the fast charging station corridors, and there it shows a list of all the potential sites that fast chargers could be located at approximately 50 miles apart that would cover the entire state. So just wanted to highlight that as well.
And we will send the link to that report, Madam Chair.
Representative, I think for that MnDOT study, we will make sure that all committee members have a copy of that. We'll try to get it in your packets for Thursday. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple years ago, and thank you, Ms. Gauthier, for the presentation, and a couple years ago, we were sort of in the midst of a conversation a lot with the Clean Power Plan, and 111D, the judge kind of stopped that in its motions, and at the time with the Dayton administration, it was unclear whether they were still investing into that project. Can you tell me with the new administration, are there resources going into this plan at this point, just to kind of get us up to speed if anything is happening or if we're really spending money on that project at this point?
Madam Chair and members, I apologize. I have an answer to that question with me today, but I will get that to you.
Thank you.
Representative Bow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually had one of my questions answered already, but I do have two remaining regarding the electric vehicles. What percent of the charging needs are occurring at the end point of the trip versus along the route of the travel? In other words, how many are needing to stop and charge multiple times to go a certain distance versus charging when they get to work or when they get back home?
Madam Chair, I believe there is a person in the audience from MnDOT today who may know some of this information.
That would be good. If that person would come up, we would appreciate it.
He was here, Madam Chair. I apologize. We did ask someone from MnDOT to be here in case there were detailed questions. He must have stepped out for a moment. Oh, there he is. Great.
Hi. Madam Chair, my name is Tim Sexton. I'm Chief Sustainability Officer with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. You know, the estimates vary a bit across the country, but in Minnesota, we estimate that about 70 to 85% of all charging takes place at home or in the workplace. And so the fast charging corridors, fast charging along some of our corridors are really important so that people can take those occasional trips, along with there's a concept called range anxiety that is very real in terms of purchasing electric vehicles and the concern that while we actually travel outside of our commutes much less than we think we do, the idea of being able to charge along those corridors to take those longer trips is really important. But again, it's a pretty small percent of overall charging.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other question having to do with food waste and recycling. So, thank you. So I know a lot of counties are struggling with the fairly lofty goals of 75% for recycling, given the fluctuations in the market for recycling as well as some geographic challenges. So my question to you, given the recent upheaval in the recycling market, are you looking in any way to relax those goals so that those counties have the ability to try to find other options, including the creation or strengthening of markets for recycled materials and that sort of stuff? Because a lot of counties are kind of between a rock and a hard place in trying to meet these goals.
Madam Chair and members and Representative Bowe, to my knowledge, I am not aware of any of that type of discussion going on, but I will check because I'm not at the office a lot these days. I'm over here, but I will check and find out. But that is one of the reasons why we have these two proposals this year, is to provide more support for the recycling markets and also to try to do more around food waste to help get that out of the waste stream to begin with. Okay. So we are trying to do those areas because we feel those have multiple benefits.
And Madam Chair, I mean, you're right, that is an area that's pardon the pun, ripe for observation and for further action in the food rescue and composting. But, you know, bear in mind that the counties are struggling, and a lot of times there are financial challenges with a county that either doesn't want to or is not able to subsidize. And so there's a lot of challenges out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Swisinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's one of the things that I've heard visiting with some of the county commissioners is, you know, from a state mandate standpoint, continuing the recycling program, yet there's very few funds that come in from the state. Is there any plan from the governor's office? You know, he's talked a lot about trying to drive down property taxes across the state to help supplement some of these recycling programs from the state budget to counties, because they're the ones kind of bearing the brunt of the mandate. Have there been any conversations with the governor about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Swisinski, I'm not aware that the commissioners had conversations like that, but I will ask her and get back to you.
Thank you. And then, Madam Chair, and then just kind of on that one page with the electric vehicle infrastructure, looking at the $50,000 going annually from the Highway User Tax District, was that the fund that's initially supposed to be going to roads, kind of in place of gas tax?
Madam Chair and Representative Swisinski, the ongoing $50,000 represents an increase to the EV registration fee of $25. So it currently is at $75. It would be raised to $100 annually under this budget proposal, and those funds would be readjusted to EV infrastructure.
Madam Chair, to the testifier, I think if I remember the conversation, I believe it was Representative Garofalo, who I think is not here today, but that start of that was $75 was essentially to replace the gas tax that those vehicles paid. And it seems kind of interesting that, you know, it's replacing gas tax to build the roads because they're not paying the gas tax, and that we're taking money from that to essentially build a gas station rather than fix the roads. So okay. I just want just kind of what's the thinking behind that, and thanks.
Madam Chair and Representative Swisinski, the $75 fee, the existing fee, would continue on in its current form. It would be the fee increase is what would be used for electric vehicle charging infrastructure.
All right. And then one final question. And then will it be leveraged dollars? You know, because obviously the state of Minnesota is not building electric vehicles. But, you know, the manufacturers, whether it be GM or Tesla or whoever, are building it. Will it leverage dollars to actually get private investment into them, or will they just simply build them themselves?
Madam Chair and Representative Swidzinski, it would leverage dollars through the grant-making process, so private dollars would be matching public dollars.
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. If you would go back to page 8 in your third bullet about removing barriers to expanding organics, tell me how you're going to address the PFAS issue.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I couldn't hear the last part of your question. I apologize.
All right. Let's go back to page 8.
Yep.
The third bullet. Tell me how you are going to address the PFAS issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this point, what we are trying to do to address the PFAS in that are being detected in the water coming off of the processing facilities for recyclables is we are trying to trace back and find out where the PFAS is coming from first so that we have a clear understanding of that. And then based on what we learn, we will then have to determine how to best address it.
Where do you expect it's coming from?
Madam Chair, we have some preliminary information. We do think it part of it is coming off of plastic, some of the plastics, Madam Chair. But I would feel remiss in saying anything specific because I don't have preliminary information in front of me and because it is preliminary. There are other streams that we're looking at too. For example, organic waste includes, of course, food, and it also includes sometimes compostable paper products that have been contaminated by food. So, for example, you're at a picnic and you're eating pizza and you get your napkin full of pizza, that becomes organic waste as well. So then it takes in that class of products. And then it also includes yard waste, clippings, trimmings, that sort of thing. So right now we're trying to determine, this is a fairly new problem that's been detected across the country, and we're trying to figure out where, tracing back the PFAS. And once we know that, then we'll have an idea of what needs to be done to address that.
If you have PFAS, and I expect you do, then are you at the same time looking for other potential problems that would, like the bisphenol A and other phthalates coming from plastic, so that we're looking at the whole range of things that could be happening rather than just focusing on one thing?
Madam Chair, I do not know the full range of chemicals that we may be looking at, but I will get that for you.
Okay. So on another issue, yes, please do that. Mm-hmm. If I heard correctly, you said that there are 17% of folks have an opportunity for pickup of their mm-hmm. organic waste. Mm-hmm. Not all of us will have that opportunity just because people live far apart, et cetera. There were not too many years ago, there was great support for helping individuals compost at home. How are you all approaching that?
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. Part of our food waste reduction initiative would also include, and I neglected to say it when I presented, it would include education and outreach for both residential and business, for both homes and businesses on how to reduce food waste. Our goal is always to reduce the amount of waste to begin with, then there's less to have to worry about with repurposing, recycling, and so forth.
Well, I think my question was more addressed after you do the reduce. Mm-hmm. Than the recycling part. We have had various initiatives in the state of giving folks at no or reduced cost a big composting bin. I have one of those in my yard that I have had for a long time. Still working. Squirrels like it, but still working. Are you going to be providing opportunities like that, since we are going to have to move a lot faster and better in reducing this methane coming from compost?
Madam Chair, thank you for your question. Our proposal does not include purchase of bins for homes. We are focusing more on moving as much food waste as we can out of the waste stream, and the impact that we can have through food rescue and food recovery and value-added industries to process food waste will have a larger overall impact. But, Madam Chair, if people want to add that to our proposal, I don't think we would. It's not out of the realm of something that could be done. I wonder if it isn't more done by local government than by state government. But
perhaps
happy
and
to
that's
talk to
the,
you.
That's their score dollars, and that would be following up on other questions over here. Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that Carver County is in the process of a multiple-year study looking at runoff from organic and yard waste projects versus yard waste projects only, due to the fact that to get permitted to do organics, to add food scraps and such, the permitting process is much more onerous. And so, number one, are there plans to make more funding available for such research projects? And then number two, I would just encourage the agency to look at ways to make that permitting process easier, because the more we can make food scrap composting available and easier for counties and private entities to begin to do and to make those facilities available, I think the better. So,
thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bowe. We'd be happy to talk about those topics with you further.
Thank you all. I see no further questions, so we'll now, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We expect a lot of things coming back. There were a lot of questions. We'll go now to House File 1022, Representative Long. Would you like to move your bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1022.
Representative Long moves that House File 1022 be laid over for possible inclusion. Tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The legislature has recognized the benefit of rooftop solar energy to Minnesota and created the Solar Energy Incentive Program, known through Excel as Solar Rewards. Solar, as we know, is an important part of doing our work to combat climate change. Solar also means good jobs for Minnesotans. Minnesota last year saw an 8% increase in solar industry jobs. We now have 4,602 solar jobs in the state, which makes Minnesota the 15th highest in the nation for solar jobs. Solar installer nationwide is the fastest growing job in the country. We also know that solar jobs aren't located just in the metro. 40% of clean energy jobs are located in greater Minnesota. So we have, I think, a lot of good news in the solar sector for Minnesotans. The Solar Rewards Program provides an incentive per kilowatt hour produced by a photovoltaic system. It's limited to 40 kilowatt systems and to not more than 120% of a customer's annual energy consumption. Monthly payments are made to the owner of the solar system in exchange for renewable energy credits, or RECs, for the energy produced by the solar system. This program has proven extremely popular. Last year, there was rollover money in the fund, so there was close to $20 million in the fund. The allocation had been $15 million, and the program sold out completely. As of the beginning of this month, the 2019 allocation was already 14% allocated, and the allocation for this year currently is $10 million. If we stayed at that allocation level, we'll likely be spent down by the summer. There's also a new low-income program that the PUC approved last year, which means that the funds are going to more places now than they had been. Having a stable program is important for meeting Minnesota consumer demand and for the still emerging solar industry in our state. The bill before us, House File 1022, adds an additional $5 million per year for 3 years and adds 1 year to the program to go to 2022. This more closely mirrors expected demand in the next several years. The bill still anticipates a phase out. We know that incentives won't be needed forever as solar's costs continue to decline, but this path more closely mirrors what we expect for the future path of declining solar costs. So just to give a summary of what the different amounts are, last year, as I mentioned, there was $20 million available, $15 million allocated under current law. This year, there's $10 million allocated. Next year, it's $10 million. And then 2021, $5 million. And then the program ends. Under the proposal, we would be at $15 million this year, $15 million next year, $15 million in 2021, $5 million in 2022, and then the program would end. The bill also moves from direct current to alternating current. This would be consistent with our net metering statute. Solar rewards is a bit of an outlier for being measured in direct current, and this would also allow consumers to put a modest amount of additional panels on their farm or business. This bill is bipartisan. The Senate companion was authored by Senator Senjum, who was joined by Senator Rosen. And so that's the proposal before us. And I'll, if you're ready, I'll bring up the testifiers on the bill. I have six people who I'd like to testify on it, and then we have some public testimony as well.
So start with your testifiers, and then after that we'll have questions, and then we'll go to public testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll invite up Liz Lucente with Mincia.
Yep, absolutely.
Hello, Madam Chair, representatives. Thanks for having us at the committee hearing today to offer testimony in support of House File 1022. My name is Liz Lucenti, and I'm the program director for MNSEA. That's the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. And we're a 501c6 nonprofit trade group. We represent the voice of the solar industry in the state. We have about 115 members, businesses, solar supporters, running the gamut across all the sectors, manufacturers, installers, developers, ancillary service providers, nonprofits, and the like. So today, thank you so much for having us. I really am excited about this. As we know, at the industry level, incentives drive industry growth. Our national partner, SEIA, estimates that about 60% compound annual solar growth has happened since the federal investment tax credit started in 2006. That's about 1,600% solar installation growth since 2006. We're really excited about Xcel's programs. This one's really great. In 2018, the Solar Roads program had about 1,700 applicants, 19 megawatts of capacity. A lot of these are 5 to 10 kilowatt systems, small systems, residential, but it goes up to 40 kilowatts, which allows a little bit of diversity. The program began in 2014. In 2017, about half of the funds originally allocated to a different Minnesota incentive program that ended were transferred into the Solar Rewards program. That program, as it's been wildly successful, the funds are running out, as Representative Long said, and the amount in the funding pool is decreasing over the next few years. The program's end date's also a little bit too close to now. It's set for 2021, as Representative Long said. And as rooftop solar is declining in cost, it's not necessarily to the point where our industry members have said it can be sustainable without an incentive by 2022. And note also that's when the federal investment tax credit for solar also goes to zero. So it's a bit of a cliff. And that's why we're here to support this bill today. The extra funding will be very helpful. And the funding issue, as I said, was dealt with in 2017 and elongated when the other program ended. About half of that went to our Solar Rewards program. And we hope that the program would be enhanced to reduce incentive targets based on solar cost curves. There's also no disputing that demand for the program remains very high. Without it, eligible residents may not go solar at all. And that's where we see a need here for a bit of an enhancement to this program and a one-year extension in the duration after that cliff in 2022 when the ITC is at zero. Last year, as Representative Long said, there was rollover money in solar rewards. It was actually close to $20 million. This year, we're about down to $10 million, and there's also a $2 million deduction from that, which I'll talk about in a second, for the low-income program, which is wonderful. There's a lot of businesses here today. I don't want to take up too much time. I want to let them speak also. But the cliff, which is abruptly ending in 2022, I think can be avoided and ensure market stability and business stability and projected growth can continue in the state. This year, the Department of Commerce and Excel, like I said, approved a new low-income solar program. We support these kinds of programs, and we hope that they would be additive to current incentive programs and not replace them, but we want all parties to win. And then lastly, there is that small change from DC direct current to alternating current that's in this language, which we also support, because it does make sense to streamline all the programs. The 216B.164 in the statutes is a net metering program. It's measured in AC. It'd be nice to see this program change to AC as well. I'm not sure. I wasn't there in the drafting days. I don't know what the origination of the DC current was. Maybe somebody here will testify to that note. But it does actually, the ratio from DC to AC does create a little bit more room for panels. So if it is done, then there's a little bit more room for a bit more solar, and we support that. So thank you so much for having me up here. I'll take any questions, and I'll pass it over to Representative Long again. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have Marty Morrood with True North Solar.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you and good morning. Appreciate your attention and listening to how this bill can positively make an impact on our industry. And as Liz mentioned, cliffs are dangerous. That's why I'm here. We see it coming. This has been a very stable and growing market in some cases, and there's been volatility in others. The loss of the Made in Minnesota program, cutting of the Solar Awards funding last year, still seems like it's a little bit up and down, and I think our children wonder why that is. So first off, a little bit about myself. I own and operate True North Solar. We're a solar construction company located out of Edina. I have 18 employees, and we have a sales and design team, a design team that focuses on permitting and interconnection, and about half of our company is construction jobs year-round, where we build the systems both electronically and mechanically and turn them on. So that's the nature of our business. This added funding directly relates to jobs in my company. The added funding would allow us to hire two additional sales and design staff, and we'd be able to hire four additional construction and electrical contractor staff. We're a licensed building contractor and a licensed electrical contractor, I should add. The average wages in our construction team is just under $28 an hour, plus PTO, plus paid federal holidays, plus health benefits, plus 401k plan. These are awesome jobs. And we have folders full of resumes of young people that want to come work in the clean energy industry. And we'd love to train them and hire them. This incentive runs for 10 years, but the systems are running for 25. In fact, some module manufacturers are extending their performance warranties out to 30 years now. So this little bit of funding now goes a long ways for a long time. I'm a fan of lowering the allocation of incentives per customer. I think that stabilizes the industry, and that's been proven around the world, that if we boost the incentive a little bit and stabilize it for as long as we can and then use it responsibly. Folks from Excel are here today, and they lowered the incentive a little bit. We flipped more switches per dollar, per incentive dollar. That's what we're doing in 2019, and I think that's going to continue. So we know these incentives aren't going to be here forever, and at least I personally commit to you that we'll use them as responsibly as we possibly can to flip as many switches as we can. So in order to do that, in order to lower these costs, you do need to boost volume. You need to stabilize that, and this funding helps us in that direction. So finally, money isn't all we're saving here, and I know you've all heard that. This is a lot more than our customers saving some funds on their bills. Me personally, I'm a snowmobiler, I'm a skier, I'm an ice fisherman. You know, I want stable weather patterns and those kinds of things. And I see the destruction that's bringing to our economy. I'm from northern Minnesota originally, and I see those changes, and I don't like them. This is about getting serious about our health and wellness and the air that we breathe and what we want our children and grandchildren to breathe for future generations. So I really hope for your support in this bill. I think it does great things for our market, our local industry, but also has so many other positive effects that would benefit us all. So thank you for your time and attention. I'm happy to take any questions and also invite you. I'm sure you get blasted with scheduling opportunities. Hey, we want to come talk to you and all that. If you ever have questions on solar energy, myself and all of my colleagues in the industry would be happy to answer your questions anytime. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll invite up my next two testifiers, Tim Golden and Braden Solem.
Hello, my name is Tim Golden. I am the owner of Winona Renewable Energy, and we have four employees. Solar's been taking off in Minnesota, and my business has been growing as a result of successful programs like Solar Rewards. Solar Rewards incentives have allowed many more of my customers to go solar. As time goes by, many more people are having the desire to generate their own electricity as a way to save money and help the environment. We have also seen an increase in our customers' use of the Solar Rewards program. Last year, the program ran out of funds, which left a few of our customers not installing solar last year. We have been in the business since the beginning of 2010, and past trends are indicating that the current Solar Rewards program will run out of funds far before the end of this year. Also, we anticipate these funds to be depleted even faster this year, due to the next year's federal tax credit decrease. As a result, this decrease will cause an increase in Solar Rewards applications this year. On top of this, the introduction of the Solar Rewards low income component will take away even more of this funding. Last year, we had about $20 million. Now, with the addition of the low income component, ramp down of the federal tax credits next year, and an ever increasing appetite by customers wanting to save money and help the environment, I believe the Solar Rewards funding could be doubled and it would still be depleted before the end of the year. Also, please consider changing the Solar Rewards DC over to AC. The Minnesota net metering law is AC, and currently the whole rest of the state uses AC versus Solar Rewards, which is the only one that I'm aware of that uses DC. I'm thinking maybe it was an error that was missed, and now we have a chance to fix it. As a side benefit, this could allow my customers to install a slightly bigger solar PV system. Please consider doubling the current Solar Rewards funding, as this will help my customers and my business, and please consider changing the DC to AC. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Braden Solem. I'm the Vice President of Business Development at Ideal Energies. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1022 and the expansion of the Solar Awards Program. The Solar Awards Program, since its inception, has supported the rapid growth of the residential and small commercial sector of the Minnesota solar industry. The participating solar array installations in this program are installed on Minnesota homes, schools, government buildings, nonprofits, and businesses. passing these incentives and significant savings directly onto them. This program and its predecessor have directly resulted in the rapid growth of our company, Ideal Energies. We are a commercial solar energy developer that has developed over 300 solar arrays that are participating in these smaller scale incentive programs. We've grown from two employees in 2010 to 35 people as of this year. Additionally, we consistently hire two contracting teams to build projects full time. We have accountants, structural engineers, consultants, advisors, et cetera, all as a result of programs like Solar Awards that have helped springboard the solar industry in the state of Minnesota. When the Made in Minnesota program was repealed in 2017, our industry was left without a solution for a majority of the marketplace for residential and small commercial solar, and the Solar Awards program was subsequently expanded slightly to help make up for this. We commend the legislature's work to replace the funding that was lost with the repeal last year, but the industry is still left with only half of the original funding that existed prior to 2017. Representative Long's bill replaces the status quo and funds the program to the original amounts allocated to our industry and our customers, and will result in continuing the rapid growth of our industry. Currently, as Representative Long mentioned, the Solar Awards program operates at capacity. There is no shortage in demand for Minnesota residential and small commercial customers, and we anticipate the program will remain oversubscribed even if the funding level is increased by the amount requested in House File 1022. Last year, the program had rollover funding resulting in almost $20 million in project funding, and the program was still sold out. That being said, the program is actually run very efficiently. The incentive levels of the program were reduced this year proportionately with the fall in cost to develop solar, resulting in a much larger project pool than the previous year, spreading the dollars as far as they can. Also, we support the language in allowing the program cap to be amended from DC to AC system capacity, as the other testifiers had mentioned. This is a logical change to the program, and it best aligns the Solar Awards program to the existing language used by Xcel Energy in their net metering policy and other policy regarding solar in their rate book. And it's an industry standard to refer to project sizes in terms of their nameplate capacity in terms of AC capacity. But with that, again, thank you for allowing me to testify and support a House File 1022. We appreciate the legislature's continued support of our solar industry. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd like to invite up John McCarthy and Addison Arnold.
Madam Chair, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to speak today. My name is John McCarthy. I'm a journeyman electrician at All Energy Solar, based here in St. Paul. I also live here in St. Paul in the Midway with my wife and 11-year-old son. 7 years ago, I was working in the book publishing industry. It was a secure, steady job, but a job in an industry that was on the decline. I came from an era that the trades were looked down upon. In high school, most people did not openly talk about becoming an electrician or a plumber, and I think there was still some stigma that made me think that I needed to do something more sort of in the business world, go to college, instead of what I wanted to do, would be more involved with work with my hands. I started my career in solar first with taking classes right here at Century College in White Bear Lake. After a few semesters, I started working for All Energy Solar, initially as an installer. Then I made my way up to crew leader. After a year or so, I started to pursue an electrical license to help broaden my skill set as well as better support my family. This last year, I took my journeyman's exam, and now I'm proud to say that I truly believe that I found what I always wanted to do. I'm truly proud to say I'm an electrician. One of the most exciting pieces to my story is that I became an electrician because of working 100% in the solar energy industry. First as a student at Century College, then a crew leader, and now a licensed electrician. The rooftop solar industry was my path to a great paying, fulfilling career. Other than talking about how I got to the position I'm in now, I wanted to mention how important providing a consistent form of funding is for customers to go solar in Minnesota. Solar reward funding has been one of the only semi-constants in my career in solar, and we need to continue funding this program appropriately. Pulling over 50% of the funding for that program in 1 year does not help. Please remember that just 2 years ago, funding for a similar program in Minnesota was gutted and removed over $15 million a year in funding. In 2018, the Solar Rewards Program funded about 1,700 projects. In 2019, we will be lucky if it funds 700. This type of cliff to funding approach is only going to hurt the industry, not help it. A very small amount of funding can be the difference between a booming, fruitful industry compared to a fledgling industry. I don't think anyone in Minnesota wants to see that happen, and keeping solar rewards funded at higher amounts will pay dividends for generations to come. Lastly, I wanted to end and explain how my story resonates throughout our solar company. Last year, our company had two people start as installers and make their way through to taking and passing their journeyman electrical exam, me being one of them. This year, All Energy Solar has six apprentices that have made their way through the four-year program and will be taking their journeyman exam shortly. And so far, for next year, we have over a dozen more that will be sitting to take their exam. I imagine that this type of local job growth is one that we can all get on board with and encourage. Thank you for your time, and please continue to support Minnesota's rooftop solar industry by increasing funding for solar rewards. I'm more than happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Madam Chair and representatives, thank you for letting me testify today. I work for Novel Energy Solutions. My name is Addie Arnold. I recently moved to Minnesota for this job at Novel, and just because the solar market here is booming and growing and I wanted to be a part of the industry. Novel Energy Solutions is a family-run energy management company started in 2012 by our CEO, who is a fifth-generation farmer in Minnesota. We work on-site solar, community solar gardens, and conservation for farmers, businesses, and residents locally. The company has grown to over 40 employees since 2012, and we're expected to double that number in the next year or two. And this is really due to the demand of solar and the opportunities that our company has had to grow. Our customers truly appreciate the increased accessibility to clean energy, and this program has helped many farms, residents, and businesses obtain solar that they otherwise might not have been able to afford. There is a need for this expansion outlined in the bill, and according to Xcel's website, as of February 2nd, only 15% of the year's budget has been allocated, and as it was mentioned, it's estimated to run out by this summer, if not raised. Also, the change from DC to AC will better align with the net metering policy, as mentioned before, and make room for additional panels to be added to a job, 15% or more panels on some farms and businesses. Overall, this incentive program is really helping to bring valuable cost savings, clean energy, and innovation to Minnesota, and I urge you to move this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I misspoke. I have one more testifier, if you'll oblige me.
Okay. And then we'll be open to public. And then we'll take questions.
Bob Preem. Bob.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was asked to testify on the spur of the moment, so we took advantage of solar rewards.
Put your name on the record.
My name is Bob Preem. I'm from Winona, Minnesota. We took advantage of the solar rewards program because it was there, and if it wasn't, we probably would not have installed solar energy. Solar energy has been very beneficial to our household. It's contributed to our wealth. We're a conservative family, and we are try to use as less energy as possible. And by doing so with electricity, it rewards us back. It's part of our retirement program. And I kind of look at a solar energy system as an appliance to our household. I would kind of wonder why more houses do not have solar energy systems in their household. The house is there. Why not add something to it that you can be rewarded with naturally? And it's a clean system, and it has been a great benefit to our family. Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes my testifier, so I think we have some public
testimony. We have questions for you, Representative Spasinski.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, just kind of in general, you know, do you kind of, like, you know how much per kilowatt, like, XL ratepayers are currently paying for this program? Kind of a per hour or however they...
Well, I can give you the performance incentive. So, Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, so for residential systems, the performance incentive is 7 cents per kilowatt hour for 2019, and then there are different rates for the income qualified, the low income program. If you'd like, I can go through those.
Madam Chair, no, I think from an XL ratepayer. So obviously, this money comes from ratepayers. You know, whether it be from Tim Mahoney's district or my own. Or not my own, but other districts across the state, how much more are they paying to kind of subsidize this program per household? Would you know what that would be?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, I don't know the per household amount. I would just say that we subsidize all forms of energy in different ways, whether it's federal dollars or state dollars, and I think that it is important to subsidize solar as an emerging industry and one that we know the prices are coming down, and pretty soon it'll be cost competitive with some of our other energy systems. Our federal government subsidizes fossil fuel energy to the tune of $14 billion a year, which is much more than they subsidize renewables, and those are locked into the tax code right now, whereas the investment tax credit is expiring in a couple of years. So we right now are tilting the scale towards fossil fuels in terms of our overall incentives that we're putting into the system. So I think this is helps rebalance it a little bit from what we see at the federal level, and then helps really stand up an industry that I think is going to be important to Minnesota's future.
Madam Chair, that's one other thing. A few of the testifiers kind of mentioned about kind of the booming industry and, you know, how prices are falling. Do you see, you know, this is a one-year extension. Do you see, you know, we keep hearing about this cliff. I mean, from an association standpoint, you know, if this bill moves forward, will you commit to not ask for another extension?
Madam Chair, Representative, we're here to support this bill as introduced, not recommend changes to policy. So this will definitely help our industry. There is that cliff we spoke about, 2022, where the residential investment tax credit amount goes to zero, and the costs from this program incentive not necessarily aligning with that. So when you're, I guess, we're happy as the association to come back and analyze from our membership what the impact has been and be in touch with you.
So no? So I'm taking that as a no.
Madam, okay, thank you.
And then one last question, Madam Chair. I know the other side, we just look out these windows, we see the snow between us, but we also see a Senate building. And I know they've been pretty adamant on potentially the reduction of the CASC fee, and, you know, how that these things move forward. And, you know, if things are going to be moving forward, if we're going to continue to dip into that fund, you know, do you think that would potentially be a part of this body's plan as well? Because I know ratepayers are the ones at the end of the day are paying this for these programs across the state. You know, I know that's ultimately what we're looking for, is trying to give people better economic opportunity and more dollars and cents in their own pocket. And we're continuing to kind of go back to that well. And I know that's kind of a goal of a lot of folks to do that. Is there any thoughts on that particular policy direction at all, Madam Chair?
I'm not sure what you're getting at. If you are asking the question, will this be laid over for inclusion in an omnibus bill, that is what is going to happen here.
Yes, Madam Chair, I understand that. But just kind of in general, you know, that's one thing we've heard, because, you know, this RDA fund or the renewable fund from the cast storage that ultimately goes through, ratepayers are paying it. You know, is there any thoughts to kind of moving that policy forward as well, kind of as a kind of in combination with a lot of these other incentive programs?
I think one of the underlying questions that you're asking is, how do these programs fit in the context of everything that Xcel, all the energy Xcel provides? And we are actually looking at for those numbers, because it keeps saying the ratepayers are paying an immense amount of money going forward, and it may turn out that in the context of the huge Xcel and these very small programs, it's not going to look like much at all. So we'll get those figures for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just, I suppose, one more thing. Just, you know, as this moves forward, what percentage of total electricity will be produced through this program with a one-year extension? Do you think, do we have those numbers at all? I know that's a little toughy. Maybe we need to get back to that one later, but that's one I'd like to see. So thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, I don't know that number off the top of my head. I believe Xcel's testifying. They might know that. I wouldn't imagine it would amount to a very high percentage.
Representative Mechelin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Long, one of your testifiers had indicated that when the subsidy had gone down that the actual sales had gone up, I believe is how he stated it. And several of your testifiers have also stated that there's far more applicants than really the money can go around. Would it make more sense if the goal is to have more solar to reduce the amount of subsidy per individual and have more applicants or participants that could get involved in this program?
Madam Chair, Representative Mechlin, so the testimony wasn't about the overall amount of the program. It was about the per kilowatt hour performance incentive, and that rate was adjusted by Xcel. That rate is not set in this bill. That's something that I believe Xcel sets with the PUC. But I believe the testimony was that with the slight reduction, it meant that a limited amount of dollars were able to go a little bit further in the program. But I think if we limit the scope too much in terms of the overall size of the program, then it's not going to be able to go very far at all.
Another question, Madam Chair. If you can help me understand that there's lots of ways to do solar, community, utility, scale, and rooftop. In the sense of rooftop, can you help me understand where that comes into cost compared to the others?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I think that we've heard testimony that utility is cheaper currently than rooftop. But we know that all solar energy costs are coming down over time. And I think part of the goal of this bill is to make sure we have a robust energy, solar energy industry in Minnesota to take advantage when we know that the costs are going to be competitive, as we have done with other emerging energy technologies in the past. I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. As the industry trade rep, we support diversity in our energy program, energy portfolios. We don't want to put all our eggs in one basket. That's the way we see it at Mencia, at least. So we support solar gardens, utility scale, rooftop. They're all different. They all relate to energy, clean energy choices, and they all have their benefits and their differences. So thank you for the question.
One more part of that, but do you have like a rough idea of the difference between the most expensive and the least expensive? I mean, how much of a variance is there between the two or the three?
Madam Chair, Representative Mechlin, the most expensive and the least expensive between which technologies?
Between the types of, whether it's utility scale or community. I'm trying to understand it as a business guy. How much difference is there from the least expensive to the most expensive?
Madam Chair, if you're just talking levelized cost of energy, I think that presentation was brought to the committee by a previous testifier in terms of what the Lazard estimates are, and I could bring that slide back up. I don't have it in front of me. But I think it's also important to
when we're talking about costs, often we're only talking about the ratepayer costs, and we're not looking at the externalities, the costs that are put on society, which involve healthcare costs, involve impact on infrastructure, et cetera. And so I think when a more accurate analysis of costs would not just be what the ratepayer is paying, but inclusive of the externalities, the impacts that different energy sources are having on the public as well. So things like health bills, things like increased taxes to take care of infrastructure, et cetera.
Thank you.
Representative Bo, and then we will hear Representative Bo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, with all the cold weather we're having lately, I can remember the exhilaration that you feel when you hook up the jumper cables and your car starts. But then the disappointment when you disconnect that jumper cable and your car doesn't run anymore. And so putting that in terms with this, the solar program is working well, but I'm concerned when we remove that jumper cable, when we remove the funding, what's your supposition for how long will be until we get to the point that the industry can stand on its own without ongoing subsidies and influx of cash?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bo. That's a good question. My best supposition right now is 2022, which is why that's the year in the bill. The cost of energy continues to come down year over year, and projecting out that that estimate seems to be about when we're going to reach a good, I think, price competitive point. And as I mentioned, the bill still has a glide path that the investment tax credit, as was mentioned on the federal level, is expiring that year. So if we went to zero in 2022, it would be zero for both, which I think is concerning to many, including myself. And so keeping at least the $5 million in this program would be a bit of a hedge against the zero for the investment tax credit. And as I mentioned earlier, the wind and solar tax credits are going to zero, but not the baked-in tax credits for the fossil fuel industry that are in the code right now. And I see our Republican researcher shaking his head, but I can get you that information.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, one other question. I've heard a couple people mention the term low-income component, but I don't know what that is. Help me to understand what the low-income component is as far as related to the solar rewards program.
Sure thing. So there, would you like to speak to that? Yeah, Excel is going to be coming up, I believe, soon, and maybe they can speak to what the program is. It was a program that was directed by the Public Utilities Commission last year, and the money is coming through the Solar Rewards program.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. We are now going to two people signed up for public testimony, and we're going to go to the public testimony right now. We have Mr. Vian Nathan, and then Rick Evans from Xcel Energy. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, thank you to this distinguished committee for giving me the opportunity to testify regarding solar energy. My name is Mauli Vaidyanathan. I'm an immigrant that has been living in the U.S. for the last 33 years. In January 2009, I founded a solar company in Minnesota, and have been running it ever since using my own patented racking system, proudly engineered here in our state. We have four issued patents and several on its way. We have solar installations in 39 U.S. states. I've come here to testify on behalf of solar distributed energy generation, where power is generated close to the load versus more centralized form of generation. As you all are well aware, one cannot put a coal plant on your roof, nor can they put a nuclear plant, a gas plant, or a hydro plant on the roof. Solar is the most practical energy generating technology that can be safely installed on the roof and close to the load. The National Renewable Energy Laboratories in its study has found that 23% of rooftops in Minnesota has the potential for solar. I believe solar on rooftops will someday become as American as apple pie. I say this because this country was founded on independence, and solar power on rooftops is a giant step towards energy independence for our citizens. Furthermore, solar on rooftops creates many local jobs. Most recently, California introduced bipartisan Solar Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights protects home and business owners to self-generate solar energy. The bill ensures that owners of distributed solar and storage are not subject to discriminatory fees or charges and cannot be prohibited by homeowners associations to pursue rooftop solar. It requires regulators to establish a streamlined and standardized process for utilities. I believe Minnesota would benefit from establishing a similar Bill of Rights. In summary, solar can reach its highest potential as distributed generation. It creates new local jobs, breaks regulatory barriers, gives homeowners and businesses greater energy independence, and provides a very good alternative to combat climate change. I urge the committee to support solar distributed energy in more aggressive ways than ever by expanding the solar rewards program to all utilities in Minnesota and considering legislation that protects every Minnesotan's right to solar. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to respond to one to Mr. Representative Shane about.
If you can talk to him after the hearing, we have about 3 minutes, and Mr. Rick Evans wants to testify too. We only have about 3 minutes left.
Okay. All I wanted to say was 96% of Minnesota's solar energy is generated through utility scale. Only 4% is rooftops.
Thank you. That's a good thing to know, actually. If you would put your name on the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Most of what I was going to say has already been said by others, and so I will try not to repeat. As had been indicated, you know, this is a program that's been around for a number of years. In past years, the program was undersubscribed, which is why we had, I think someone mentioned, $6 million left over from prior years that we were able to devote to 2018. But as has also been described, there's been an increase in demand for the program. So this is a program that's very popular with our customers. I did want to mention, I didn't know this until just this week, but for Representative Akam's benefit, we have 197 schools in our service territory who have taken advantage of the Solar Rewards Program. And so when we're meeting with you this afternoon, I know, to talk about your Solar in Schools bill, we might see if we can find some way to make these programs work in conjunction. Program currently has put about 19 megawatts of solar energy on our system, and we are likely to see that much more come in the next couple of years. The one thing that I'll say is that in terms of how much money, and this has already been mentioned as well, in terms of how much money to devote to this program. We're going to remain agnostic because there's just only so much money in the RDA, and we'll let the legislature sort that out and decide how much should be devoted for this purpose versus, I think, all the other purposes that are going to be coming forward. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I think some people had some questions earlier, but I didn't make a note of all of them. So, but if there are questions in the time that's remaining, I'd be happy to answer.
I haven't seen any questions, so thank you for your testimony. Representative Long, we're nearing the end of our time. Would you renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Long renews his motion that House File 1022 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. We have no further business, and the meeting is adjourned.